Okay. Thank you, Tom. Thank you very much, Tom, and thank you for the introduction, and good morning, everybody. And it's really nice to be here. I was here once before, a couple of years ago. It's nice to be back. And thanks to Tom for the introduction, and I've got many good memories of seeing Tom at Serenity House with his guitar, sitting with a patient out in the little patio area in front of their rooms, you know, next to the oak trees and with the water, but Tom playing his guitar, and somebody perhaps in the final week or two of their life singing along with him and just making that beautiful connection. So thank you, Tom, for your beautiful work. I don't know if you heard that. Thank you. So I'm going to... Judith asked me to respond, or not respond, but to look at the three chapters from Spiritual Ecology, chapters 3, 8, and 18, all of which I've read and enjoyed. I'm going to be focusing mostly, most of my remarks are going to come from chapter 3, which is the little piece written by Thich Nhat Hanh on the bells of mindfulness, as he calls it. But I'd like to start with a poem of Wendell Berry called A Piece of Wild Things, which I think speaks to the theme of this series and indeed of my talk this morning. When despair grows in me and I wake in the night at the least sound in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the woodrake rests in his beauty on the water and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting for their light. For a time I rest in the grace of the world and am free. For a time I rest in the grace of the world and am free. So what I'd like to do to just begin is to read a few short passages from Thich Nhat Hanh's Bells of Mindfulness chapter that particularly struck me. The bells of mindfulness are sounding all over the earth. We're experiencing floods, droughts, and massive wildfires. Sea ice is melting in the Arctic, and hurricanes and heat waves are killing thousands. The forests are fast disappearing. The deserts are growing. Species are becoming extinct every day, and yet we continue to consume, ignoring the ringing bells. All of us know that our beautiful green planet is in danger. Our way of walking on the earth has a great influence on animals and plants, yet we act as if our daily lives have nothing to do with the condition of the world. We're like sleepwalkers, not knowing what we're doing or where we're heading. Whether we can wake up or not depends on whether we can walk mindfully on our Mother Earth. The future of all life, including our own, depends on our mindful steps. We have to hear the bells of mindfulness that are sounding all across our planet. We have to start learning how to live in a way that a future will be possible for our children and our grandchildren. We need a collective awakening. There are among us women and men who are awakened, but it's not enough. Most people are still sleeping. We've constructed a system we can't control. It's time for each of us to wake up and take action in our lives. And then in his final paragraph, he addresses Buddhists, but what he is saying addresses us all. Buddhism is the strongest form of humanism we have. It can help us to learn to live with responsibility, compassion, and loving kindness. Every Buddhist practitioner should be a protector of the environment. And this particularly is for each of us. We have the power to decide the destiny of our planet. If we awaken to our true situation, there will be a change in our collective consciousness. We have to do something to wake people up. We have to help the Buddha to wake up the people who are living in a dream. We have to help the Buddha to wake up the people who are living in a dream. And to this I say absolutely yes. Yes, I totally agree. We have to wake up, and we have to do what we can to help others to wake up to what's happening, to what's happening to this planet Earth, our home, our mother, for the sake of our children and for our children's children. And so the question becomes for me, yes, I totally agree, but how? And Thich Nhat Hanh in his piece doesn't really go into the how of that. Other than to say, as I read, that whether we can wake up or not depends on whether we can walk mindfully on Mother Earth. So he really kind of focuses on the importance of mindfulness in awakening to what's happening, in being aware of what's happening, and in being present to what's happening. Mindfulness is at the heart of awakening of enlightenment. We practice breathing, as in mindfulness of breathing, to be able to be here in the present moment so we can recognize what's happening in us and around us. So the practice of mindfulness can help us to be more present to what's happening within ourselves, but also to what's happening in our world. So that question, you know, yes, totally agree with what Thich Nhat Hanh is calling us to, but how to do that? That's a question that's been very much there for me, and a question I've been carrying in my heart, soul, for some years now. Along with a related question, you know, what can I do about this? You know, what have I got to contribute that could make a difference? I've known for some time, you know, what's going on. I've been aware of it, not just from the media, but from close friends who are climate scientists and environmental activists. I do realize how serious things are for our planet and for our world. But what I also know is that for me, in any case, information alone is not enough. Reading about what's happening, seeing what's happening on the TV or in movies, hearing what's happening in discussion, it's really important, but for me, it's not enough. And what I mean by that is that too much information, especially too much bad information, you know, it scares me. I feel frightened, and I feel overwhelmed, and that tends to have the effect of kind of, if anything, shutting me down. And that's not in any way to take away from the work of people like Bill McKibben and, you know, organizations like 350.org and just so many organizations and Greenpeace and so on who are out there who are doing amazing work, who are bringing that information. But sometimes I have seen, at least it seems to me, sometimes I've seen that information about what's being used in a way that's almost intended to induce fear, hoping that fear will wake people up and will stimulate action. And I think sometimes it can. You know, one comes out of watching Al Gore's latest movie, you know, sort of alarmed by the clarity of how he presents the situation. And that certainly stimulates me to think, what can I do? What can I do in my life? What can I do in my world to make a difference? But somehow that information-based, fear-based approach, while of some benefit in terms of awakening, doesn't bring me to the kind of awakening it doesn't awaken me in a way that I'm awake with an open heart. It kind of awakens me in a kind of scared, kind of almost panicky way. What can I do? You know, what can I do? And so, you know, on that basis, I've done what I can in the past. You know, I've done what I can in our home to recycle, go to the farmer's market, to have solar panels on our house. But at some deeper level, I just know that that's not enough. And then in addition to that feeling of overwhelm, of not knowing what to do, then within the last 5 years, my first grandchild was born, Elliot, who's now four and a half years old. And since then, I have two other little grandsons. And I know many, many, many of you in this room will kind of have this experience of not just having children, but having grandchildren. And just the thought of what kind of future are they going to grow up into? And what kind of world are they going to grow up into? What kind of world are we leaving our grandchildren? And so that combination of, yes, I must wake up and stay awake. Yes, I must do what I can to help others to awaken to what's happening and to enable what change I can. But how can I do that in a way that isn't just based on fear, that doesn't just come from a sense of fear and guilt, which is kind of where some of my old response came from. So in a sense, what I've just described is how I felt and how I was maybe up to even 5 years ago. But I kind of feel in some ways I'm in a different place today to where I was then. I'm not so afraid. Yes, at times I get very scared by what's happening, but not so much in the past, and I feel freer to act, to do what I know I can do, knowing that the little I can do, if it is to make a difference, will probably not be something that I see happening, you know, even in my lifetime. But that's okay. You know, the idea it's okay to plant an acorn even if we're not around to see the oak tree, because the oak tree will be there for our grandchildren. And one of the things that makes this possible is kind of really the kind of growing sense of how this isn't something that any of us can do alone, that this is something that happens in community. It's a reminder of what Thich Nhat Hanh calls interbeing, that we all inter-are. We don't exist as separate, solid individuals. That's one of the great gifts that I've taken from the Buddha's teachings, is the kind of delusion of separateness, as somebody has put it, that we carry, particularly in the Western world, the delusion that we are solid and separate individuals. What the Buddha woke up to on the night of his enlightenment was the nature of reality. And what he saw was that reality exists as an interdependent, interactive, co-arising set of causes and conditions. So everything inter is, we inter are. We exist because we're in relationship to others and to our world and to all kinds of factors that we can't even see or name. And this is, there's this coming into being and there's this passing out of being, but there's this constant interdependence and interconnectivity. And this brings a sense of deep belonging, of not being alone, even if there's no guarantee of outcome. So, as Tom kindly mentioned in his introduction, recently, actually, on the 27th of February, my third book was published, and it's called The Nest in the Stream, Lessons from Nature on Being with Pain. And really, what this book is about, it kind of speaks so much to what this study series is about. It's really my attempt to find an answer to those questions. You know, how do I wake up? How do I stay awake? not just in a scared, frightened way, but with an open heart. You know, carrying those questions, how can I do this and how can I make a difference, or at least do something that might make a difference for my grandchildren and for all the grandchildren. So those are the questions I was holding that led to my new book. And so a part of what I want to do in exploring more deeply Thich Nhat Hanh's challenge and his questions is to share some stories from my book. And I'll start by saying 10 years ago, I was invited, along with a number of co-authors, I was invited to write an article about self-care. And it was for the Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA, which is the most widely read medical journal in the world. And we were asked to write an article, which was the end of a series on end-of-life care. And the article we were asked to write was about self-care of clinicians working at the end of life. Self-care of clinicians working at the end of life. And so I was the lead author on that project, and so, you know, ended up doing a lot of the research. And it was really interesting for me. I mean, I'd heard a lot about burnout, but I learned a lot more about burnout. And I learned a lot about other so-called occupational stress syndromes, so-called compassion fatigue, moral distress syndrome. These are all different kind of very distinct kind of syndromes that are now recognized, coming not just from occupational stress, but really from the stress of caregiving. And so any of us that are involved in caregiving a loved one, pet, a spouse, a partner, a child, any of us that are involved in long-term caregiving could probably relate to some of these syndromes. And just very quickly, just to touch on the difference between the three, burnout is described as the kind of a result of constant stress between an individual and institutional or organizational, bureaucratic kind of stressors. In the article, we had a doctor, an oncologist, and he said, what burns me out is not losing my patients, it's fighting with insurance companies. So it's that kind of organizational stress, day after day, hour after hour, that gives rise to burnout. Compassion fatigue, as the name suggests, is more about the interaction between you and another individual who's suffering. Some people really don't like the term compassion fatigue because they say true compassion doesn't fatigue. But and there are other names for it. It's also called secondary traumatic stress disorder or vicarious traumatization because it results from being close in an open-hearted way to somebody who's suffering. And you, as the caregiver in that situation, can literally feel the other's pain. And while that brings real connection and compassion, it can also lead to secondary traumatization. And people who work a lot in the field of trauma kind of came up, were the ones who named this phenomenon. And then the third syndrome, moral distress syndrome, is where you're working in a situation where you know internally, you have a sense with your internal moral compass, you have a strong sense of what needs to happen, of what you need to do. But your external circumstances constrain you from acting on that. And so there's this kind of mismatch between your internal values and how you can act in your situation. And that gives rise to stress and a sense of So that gives rise to stress and a sense of self-doubt is a particular characteristic of moral distress syndrome. So anyway, I was reading all about these different syndromes and found it very interesting. And we were coming up with a kind of a program of how to address this, which I'll say more about in a moment. But one evening, I just was reading through a description of burnout. the three classical features of burnout. Chronic physical and emotional exhaustion, a kind of sense of depletion that you don't recover from even after a good night's sleep, or even a weekend's rest, or even a vacation. You come back feeling like the battery is still drained. A sense of lack of personal accomplishment. That means that you never quite feel you're doing the job you want to do. It's always falling short, and you kind of feel bad about that. And then the third one is kind of a sense of dissociation or distancing. You just don't feel quite as engaged and in your work in the same way as you were before. It can lead to a certain kind of detachment and dissociation. I read through this list and it was like a kind of a light bulb went on, because I recognized a description of how I was feeling. Not in a kind of an extreme acute way, but in a kind of chronic low-grade way, I could really relate. And I realized at that moment that I was burnt out. And I hadn't really thought of myself as burnt out, so that was kind of a little bit of a shock. But I realized it really fitted. And another symptom, which was kind of, I don't know, was peculiar to me, but I added to that those cardinal three features of burnout, was that I had a constant recurring fantasy of leaving medicine. Kind of, I've been doing this end-of-life work now for, almost 30 years. I've kind of day in, day out, been in the presence of all this pain and suffering. It's been very meaningful work, but maybe it's time for a break. You know, there's more to life than pain and suffering. And so I had been strategizing on how could I possibly do this, and it wasn't easy, but I was thinking about it. Anyway, I was kind of, I was a little disappointed in myself when I realized this, because here I was, writing this article, advocating self-care strategies, all of which I was practicing, but clearly they weren't working for me. I was saying, we need to use traditional models of self-care, like having at least good enough professional boundaries when we're in the workplace, and leaving our work behind us and having a good life outside of work. I was also practicing some of the newer approaches to self-care that we were advocating in the article, such as mindfulness. Mindfulness meditation was part of my day. I was gardening. I had a happy home life. It just didn't fit with some of the usual descriptions of what causes burnout. And so I I then thought about it, and I used the same skill set that I bring into my work every day. I've just come from the hospital where I've, been working since 8 o'clock this morning. I've seen four people, all of whom were in pain. And so I've been brought in to try and help them with their pain. One poor gentleman I saw has a recurrence of a cancer on his scalp. And he's had a big skin graft, and then right next to the skin graft, a tumor has recurred. And so he's got a combination of numbness up there and severe pain at the same time. So I describe this to show you how I approach pain, which is, first of all, to notice what's going on, to hear the patient's description of what's going on, and then to carefully analyze the cause of what's happening. And so in his case, I can see that he's got, because of the numbness, he's clearly got some nerve damage, some nerve involvement. So nerve involvement is part of his pain. But also he's got a lot of redness and inflammation. So inflammation is part of the pain. So on that basis, knowing that it's due to soft tissue involvement, inflammation, and nerve involvement, I'll then choose different medications that are helpful for nerve pain, for inflammation, and for pain in general, and kind of balance that cocktail, if you like, to try and get a good response. So that method of analysis, of trying to understand the precise mechanism, I kind of turned that inwards at that point to try and understand, why was I burnt out if I was doing all the things I'm recommending in this article and I'm still burnt out, or I'm burnt out. And so around that time, I went on a vacation, and I want to read the first little passage from my book at this stage, which describes kind of what happened next. It was around this time that I took a scheduled summer vacation. I spent 2 weeks with my family in West Cork in Ireland. I had a wonderful time. I returned to work, rested and replenished. I remember my first morning back, walking into the inpatient palliative care office at 9 a.m. that Monday morning. One of my colleagues commented on how relaxed I looked. We chatted a little and then began the morning routine of going through our list of patients, triaging as we went who would see whom. The nurse who had worked the weekend filled us in on each patient. The first person she talked about was Frank. Frank was 53 years old, had a long history of lung disease. He now had anoxic brain injury, meaning his brain had been damaged from a lack of oxygen following a heart attack and a cardiac arrest. He'd been on a ventilator in the intensive care unit for several days, and attempts to wean him off had so far been successful. Frank was a widower and a caretaker of a young family, including a 10-year-old daughter with severe disability from cerebral palsy. He'd no advance directive. He was what's called full code, meaning that if his heart were to stop, the doctors and nurses would do everything possible to start his heart again. He stopped breathing, everything would be done to help his breathing, including intubation and ventilation if necessary. What's more, there was disagreement between Frank's children and his siblings about the future direction his care should take. A family meeting was scheduled for 10 a.m. Without pause, the nurse moved on to the next patient, a 42-year-old woman with advanced ovarian cancer, who was suffering pain and vomiting due to a bowel obstruction. And the next, a 36-year-old man with a non-healing compound fracture of his tibia and fibula, the bones in his lower leg, with osteomyelitis, meaning it was a compound fracture, meaning the skin had been broken, infection had got into the bone, and so he now had a non-healing fracture with osteomyelitis, acute on chronic pain, opioid tolerance, and then the next, a 96-year-old woman who'd had a massive stroke and was showing no signs of improvement in almost a week, but whose daughter wanted everything done, including the placement of a tracheostomy and a feeding tube. These were just the first four patients. There were 12 more to go. Sorry about this. But that's exactly, that. This is in a way the point, because as I listened to this litany of human suffering, I felt like a soft-shell crab, which is, I imagine, how most of you are feeling this morning, because you don't have the same kind of defenses that those of us that are working in this kind of environment have to have just to survive day after day after day. And I hadn't got those defenses when I went in that morning because I'd been on vacation for 2 weeks. I felt like a soft-shelled crab. It was painful to hear these stories. I noticed that I was tightening up and pulling back to try and protect myself from what I was hearing. It was just too much. I found myself thinking that those of us who work with pain and suffering like this every day hugely underestimate the toll our psyches are taking. We focus on fixing what can be fixed and having the conversations that can be had. We negotiate the politics and the egos of the workplace. We do our best with the family dynamics. Meanwhile, we've already started to engage with the next story of suffering and the next and the next. At that moment, I became aware of what felt like an old, aching hurt in the center of my chest. I saw that good boundaries, enjoyable times out, and even self-awareness and mindfulness practices were simply not enough. I remembered Dr. C, the medical oncologist who we'd interviewed for our JAMA article, who'd said, "The stuff that burns me out has nothing to do with loss. It's fighting insurance companies." And I realized that for me, in contrast to Dr. C, it was the opposite. It was precisely the accumulated losses and daily encounters with human pain and suffering that were burning me out. And burnout, by the way, is the common endpoint of all those three occupational stress syndromes. So compassion fatigue, if it becomes a chronic phenomenon, ends up in burnout. Moral distress syndrome, if it's chronic, ends up in burnout. Earlier in the chapter, I talked about different ways I had learned in my medical career, in my work in depth psychology. I'd learned different ways of being with pain. And I refer to these ways here. Neither of the two ways of being with pain that I'd learned so far, what I've called the medical model and the path of the wounded healer, were of much help to me in the face of this suffering. As I thought about this, I slowly began to realize why. So I was doing that analysis I talked about earlier, that self-analysis now of trying to understand the mechanism of burnout. Pieces were beginning to fall into place. As I thought about this, I slowly began to realize what was going on. What I had learned so far had taught me a lot. From the medical model, from medicine and my medical training, I'd learned how to diagnose and treat another person's fixable pain, those aspects of pain that can be fixed. And with the path of the wounded healer, which is another talk in itself, I'd found a potentially transformative way of being with another in their unfixable pain. However, what was totally missing was any real instruction on what to do with my own pain. I had not been taught about what to do with what I was experiencing in the face of another's anguish. You know, what was going on in that office that morning as I was hearing those stories of pain and suffering? Pain and suffering that I was hearing in response to the other's suffering. What was I doing with that? It was going in there. It was causing me pain and suffering. But I just didn't even have time to pay attention to it because it was the next situation and the next and the next. I had not been taught about what to do with what I was experiencing in the face of another's anguish. And I saw at that moment that it was precisely this, not knowing what to do with the pain I was experiencing, that was leading to my feeling overwhelmed and burnt out. I knew I had to find another way, a better way of being with pain. So I'd learned a lot about pain, how to deal with, how to be with another's pain, but I really hadn't learned very much about being with my own pain. And so that became the search, and that's why it's the subtitle of my book, Lessons from Nature on Being with Pain, because my greatest teacher in response to holding those questions has been nature. And I've had some really powerful teachings from nature in response to that question. How can I be with my own pain in a better way, in a way that could possibly even enliven me and sustain me rather than kind of deaden me and drain me? And so in the course of that search, that became a spiritual quest in a way, to find that better way of being with my own pain. And in a way, that became the journey of this, what ended up as a little book, because initially it led me in some wonderful and fascinating directions. The first person it led me to was an Irish writer called John Moriarty. And Maureen, I know, knows John Moriarty and his work. He's probably not very well known over here in the States, but he's just an incredible thinker, poet. In fact, he's more somebody who comes from the oral tradition, very much in that Celtic oral tradition, and he's wonderful to listen to. He's an amazing voice and just an incredible turn of phrase, very poetic, but also incredibly deep. When he puts his words in books, they become 500-600 page books that are very circular. You know, you go in there and you're kind of, it's a bit like reading James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, if any of you have tried that one. But and I don't want to put you off. There is a book, if any of you are interested, called John Moriarty Compendium, which is a sort of an anthology of his collected works with commentary, which makes it much more accessible. Anyway, that's where I went to initially. And then my search took me in another direction. I mean, in fact, it wasn't so much another direction. It just felt like the circle was getting wider and wider, kind of like a spiral. that was going around and kind of include. So what was there before was there and really meaningful, and now somebody else was coming in. And the next person who came in was Joanna Macy. And I know you've already had a session from Rattley on her work. And Joanna's an amazing 88-year-old lady who's still working, thinking, writing, a Buddhist scholar and environmental activist. I'll say a little bit more about her work later, but her thinking and her work, which is very much engaged Buddhism, so not Buddhism for personal enlightenment, so much as Buddhism to improve our world, and Buddhism to lessen the suffering of others. And the next person who came into the widening spiral was somebody called John Young. And John Young is a youngish man, still in his 40s. He's a tracker, a nature tracker. He's an anthropologist. He's a leader in a movement that's called the New Nature Movement, that very much is advocating kind of reintroducing nature connection for children, particularly recognizing that there's a whole generation of young people that are now growing up disconnected from the natural world. Some of you may be familiar with this work and may know of a writer called Richard Louv, who wrote a book called Last Child in the Woods, which talks about what he describes as nature deficit disorder. We've heard of attention deficit disorder. Well, nature deficit disorder is what many of our young people are now growing up with. You know, kind of studies that show young people have 9 hours of screen time in an average day with their cell phones and their computers, but aren't sent outside to play anymore. You know, we call you when it's time for dinner, which many of you in this room will have grown up with, as I did. So John's work is very much in here, as is Joanna's, as is John Moriarty. And then perhaps most powerfully, the search led me sort of back to the earth itself, back to the sacred earth and the sacredness of the earth. And I particularly was, you know, blessed to come across Wolf and Lisa, who you met in an earlier session, Wolf and Lisa Wapipaw, and their fireplace or their community, and to be able to attend their ceremonies and become part of their practices, which I've been able to do since about 2005. Just this Monday, I was at a sweat lodge ceremony of theirs in Oxnard, which happens every Monday evening. And it's just incredible having this earth-based practice of prayer that kind of recognizes the aliveness of our world. That is, Wolf and Lisa are very traditional, you know, in how they practice. There's nothing sort of new age about how they do it. Some of the indigenous practices now that are being offered are being offered by those that don't come directly from an indigenous tradition, but Wolf and Lisa are steeped in that tradition. And just to be incredible blessing to have them so close by and to be offering these ceremonies. I think I'm very grateful for that. And it was actually with Wolf and Lisa, we were co-hosting a weekend retreat together at La Casa de Maria. It was in June of 2012. And the weekend was called Silver Branch Perception, which was actually a phrase from John Moriarty, one of his stories, which I don't have time to go into now. And it was around the theme of all my relations, you know, that all of creation are our relations. And as part of that weekend, Wolf and Lisa sent all of us who are participating in this retreat on a sort of mini vision quest. They sent us out onto the land of La Casa de Maria, the beautiful grounds of La Casa de Maria that have been so damaged by the recent mud flows. I was with Steve Jacobson, who's the CEO of La Casa, the other day, and he was describing, some of you may have been to La Casa de Maria since the mudslides, but he he was describing how one half of the property is still absolutely pristine. You know, that side over to the east, the eastern side of the property, where the old Immaculate Heart building is, the Spiritual Renewal Center, the organic orchard, that whole side is still just as it was before. Fruit is still on the trees. Then the other side is just like, you know, as you, many of you have seen, maybe very close up. They're just totally reshaped and reformed by the debris flow that's gone through. And the creek, where the story I'm just about to share with you happened, is no longer apparently a V-shaped kind of irregularly V-shaped creek with kind of huge boulders that have been there, I assume, for thousands of years, if not millions of years. Apparently, it's now U-shaped. It comes out almost to the road. It's just been hollowed out by this torrential flow that went through there. So, devastation. But at that particular time, La Casa was in its natural state and in all its beauty. And Wolf and Lisa sent us all out onto the land. And let me just read you another little piece from my book. It's 3 pages or so. But it describes an event that became the title of this book, The Nest in the Stream. You might be wondering where that title came from, and it explains that. And also, it offers an answer to the question I was holding, which is, how can I be with my pain? My pain for others, the pain I feel for others, the pain I feel for our world. How can I be with that pain in a way that doesn't overwhelm me or just totally scare me and shut me up? How can I be with that pain in a way that could actually kind of sustain me, as I say, rather than drain me? Wolf and Lisa smudged us down with the smoke from a smoldering stem of dried white sage and gave each of us a glass of water and a pinch of tobacco to take with us. They instructed us to go silently out onto the land and to walk about looking for a place where we'd like to spend some time. I made my way down to a creek among the trees to the east. Many of you will know that creek. I found a spot that was secluded and accessible, and with some awkwardness, because I had no free hands to steady myself, descending the steep, dry, leaf-covered creekside to the water's edge. At first, I just stood there, looking at the rocks in the creek bed upstream and watching and listening as the water flowed around them. It was June, and there was still water in the creek, so it had been a good winter rain. I was standing at a place where the stream broadens into a pool. Looking down, I noticed that the water at my feet was utterly still and clear, reflecting the blues and greens of what was overhead. But there was something else. There was something unusual, partially submerged in the water. Small branches, twigs in a swirl. It was a large bird's nest. I instinctively looked up into the branches of the sycamore tree above me. When I found a spot where I could safely leave the tobacco and water, I walked to where there were some stepping stones going across the creek. I was able to squat down on one of these and look back into the pool. I was directly downstream of the nest. As I looked more closely, I could see that it was perfectly intact. It couldn't have been in the water very long because there were still pieces of wool interwoven with the twigs. The weave of the nest appeared loose, yet solid. There were spaces between some of the coils, and I could tell the water was flowing through as fine threads of what looked like hair or grass were waving lazily at its lower edge. As I squatted there looking at the nest with the water flowing through, I became aware of a loosening in my torso and limbs. I imagined water flowing through me. I felt like I was being washed clean, as though I was letting go of something heavy that I had been carrying around for a long time. Before I left, I poured the glass of water on the ground and dropped the tobacco in the stream in gratitude. When I returned, Wolf and Lisa and everyone else were sitting around in a circle under the oaks. We each shared our stories. The image of the nest in the stream, with the water flowing through it, and the phrase, the loose and open weave of the heart stayed with me all through that night. Then just read a little bit of a reflection on what this meant to me. The nest in the stream speaks to me of a way of being that is deeply receptive. Our hearts pump, but only after they've opened their atria wide to receive the body's blood. Receptivity is neither a feminine nor a masculine quality. It's how our heart is in its most relaxed state. Our hearts are designed to receive before they pump, and our lives depend on this happening. It's important to distinguish between receptivity and passivity. Passivity suggests defeat and may have negative connotations, especially to those who've been on the receiving end of abusive power relationships. Receptivity, on the other hand, implies a conscious choice. Choosing an attitude of receptivity, choosing to open our hearts wide and to keep them open even in the face of suffering, is a courageous and powerful way of meeting the world. John Moriarty speaks eloquently about this. He describes this stance as a new kind of heroism. He says, a hero like Cú Chulainn is an old Irish hero who went out and fought the waves. You know, he just had that sword, a bit like Hercules. You know, it was this, the old archetype of the hero. A hero like Cú Chulainn isn't what we need. We need another kind of hero altogether. The hero now isn't somebody who goes out and fights the sea. The hero now isn't somebody who wields a sword. It's somebody who puts down his sword and lets nature happen to him. The new kind of hero is one who faces life with an open and receptive heart. In watching The Nest in the Stream, I began to understand the relationship between receptivity and compassionate action. As the heart opens, receives, and swells before it pumps, so the impulse to act is born in receptivity. When we come into the state of being that is deep receptivity, the impulse for compassionate action emerges spontaneously. Bernie Glassman, the author and founder of Zen Peacemakers, writes, "When we bear witness, when we become the situation, whether it's homelessness or poverty or illness, violence, death, when we bear witness, the right action arises by itself. We don't have to worry about what to do. We don't have to figure out solutions ahead of time. Peacemaking is the function of bearing witness. Once we listen with our entire body and mind, loving action arises." I'm reminded of a teaching from my root tradition, in Catholicism, that continues to be full of significance for me. The angel Gabriel has just announced to the Virgin Mary that she's to give birth to a child who will be the Messiah for whom Israel is waiting. I imagine Mary pausing. I imagine her head saying, "That's impossible," and her heart saying, "What if?" I imagine her confusion. I imagine the moment she chooses to trust as she opens to the silence between the words, and I hear her reply, "Let what you've said be done unto me." In consciously opening to the flow of what is, the miraculous happens. Above all, the nest in the stream... Just 5 minutes. Is that okay? I didn't know. I'm aware that we're at 11. I just wanted to finish this little piece. Above all, the nest in the stream teaches me a new way of being with pain. It would be a pity if I didn't come to this piece, because this is my own, the pain of others and our worlds. I've come to see that there are different elements to this teaching that interweave with one another. The first of these is that the nest is in the stream. The nest is not up in the branches of the sycamore above the stream, where in a sense it belongs. It's in the stream, which is unusual, and like an out-of-context image in a dream, calls particular attention to itself. The nest in the stream shows me how I am inextricably connected with the rest of nature. It speaks of how, in my deepest identity, I'm immersed in the flow of life. The nests being in the stream tells me that it begins by my realizing this, by my remembering this, by my experiencing this. When I look more closely, I see that the water is flowing through the nest. I recognize this is only possible because the nest itself, how it's structured, allows this to happen. The teaching I receive here is about opening to the pain that I'm feeling, not just being present to pain, but consciously and as deliberately as a buffalo with an approaching storm, turning to face it head on. And as I do this, letting it flow into me. As the water continues to flow through the nest, I understand that this is not just about being receptive to the pain, but about allowing myself to feel it. Now, this might sound very paradoxical, that the actual medicine for being with pain involves opening to the pain. Not just turning towards the pain, but actually opening and allowing ourselves to experience it. But, just to say at this point, that's not the final piece. This is about experiencing in my body what Eugene Gendlin calls the felt sense of the pain, that internal sense. This is about suffering my suffering. So actually, consciously, for a few moments, allowing myself to suffer my suffering. When I step back, I notice the bigger, deeper stream that is flowing over and between the rocks, upstream and downstream and to either side of the nest. I see that the essence of the stream is in its always flowing. It's always flowing through. And as I see this, I hear an invitation not to cling to my pain, not to ruminate on the narrative of who's to blame and what the pain is about, but instead to return again and again, if necessary, to the felt sense, and then, and this is really important, to surrender it, to let it go to the always flowing through of the deeper stream. The stream is always flowing through. It enters the nest. We allow the pain to enter, and we for a few moments allow ourselves to experience. But then we let it go. Then we release it. Finally, as I expand my awareness further still, I see that the stream is flowing into the river. The river is flowing into the ocean. The ocean is rising as clouds. The clouds are falling as rain. The rain has once again become the stream, that all is flow, that all is flowing through. I understand then what Wolf means when he says that pain is energy, and that the energy that is our pain doesn't belong to us. When we unconditionally release our pain to the earth, we're releasing energy back into the great creative cycling that is life. I see now that I don't have to hold on to my pain, that I can let it go to the deeper stream, and that I can do so in the hope that it may be of benefit to others in a way that I cannot see or imagine and will never know. And then, just to finish, Thich Nhat Hanh, we need to help the Buddha to wake up the people who are living in a dream. Yes, but how? By coming back to earth. By remembering that we are not only of the earth, but that we are the earth. Not in a conceptual way. We've got to come back or not come back to an experience of that. We are the earth on two legs with opposable thumbs and brains that are capable of self-awareness and of imagining the future. We have the capacity to choose what we pay attention to. We have that incredible capacity of choice. And the great American psychologist William James says, what we attend to becomes reality. What we attend to. And what we don't attend to falls away. But what we attend to becomes reality. By choosing to pay attention to and honoring our pain. And I end with these words of Joanna Macy. And this was from an interview she gave with Krista Tippett. In Krista Tippett's program On Being. Some of you will be familiar with that wonderful interview series she does. So she's interviewing Joanna, and at this point in the discussion, Joanna is talking about what we've just been discussing here. And she says, she describes this, because I've received this teaching from Joanna, and she's got amazing meditations that go with this, one of which I hope to share with you after the break. The most pivotal point, she says, the most pivotal point in the landscape of my life is the dance with despair. And to see how we're called not to run from the discomfort or the grief or the feelings of outrage or even fear, and that if we can be fearless in being with our pain, it turns, it doesn't stay static. It only doesn't change if we refuse to look at it. But when we look at it, when we take it in our hands, when we can just be with it and keep breathing, it turns. It turns to reveal its other face. And the other face of our pain for our world is our love for our world, our absolute inseparable connectedness with all life. We feel that pain. We feel the pain we're feeling to the point of being overwhelmed by it, because we're so deeply connected with our world. And the paradox and the discovery that Joanna and others have talked about, and that I also learned through the nest in the stream, is that if we can be with that pain, if we can allow that pain, if we can honor that pain, it turns. And the other side of our pain for the world, as Joanna said, is our deep connectedness with all of life. So thank you.